Hi, my name's Gary King, and I've assembled the most formidable JFK team on planet Earth. We've got Dr. James Fetzer, Larry Rivera, who is the number one researcher in the world today when it comes to new research, and we've got Don Fox, who's not afraid to look a little bit deeper than anyone else. So if you're interested in what happened to the 35th President of the United States, then I invite you to our show. It's called The New JFK Show. And it's on YouTube. Go to Gary King YouTube channel, and we've got over 90 shows archived for you there. So if you really want to know the truth, and knowing that over 9 out of 10 researchers are working the other side of the street in a sea of disinformation, I pledge to you the truth about JFK. Go to Gary King YouTube channel and find out your true history.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful, I'm just a patsy. And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
One.
PhD from NYU in 1971. He has a website where he discusses issues related to religion, science, philosophy, and theology. David, welcome to The Real Deal.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me, how did you get involved in all this stuff? Was it a natural growth or extension of your work in physics? I know it was theoretical physics in the end.
Well, I had a very good... I went to a Jesuit college, and they inspired me to become a Catholic. And I guess about 10 years ago, I started to blog and write about science and religion.
You were not Catholic when you entered Fordham?
Not really. No, my parents were nominally Catholic, but they didn't give us a Catholic education. But I went to confirmation. But my faith really deepened when I went to Fordham.
Really? Yeah. Do you care to elaborate on that?
No, I believe in I believe that Jesus is alive and a new life with God, or will be at the end of time, and that if you follow Jesus, the same good thing can happen to you. We're not guaranteed salvation. It's something to hope for with fear and trembling. So I'm not really interested in theology. The difference, I'm really just interested in promoting belief in life after death. And all religions believe in life after death, the Eastern and the Western religions. So I'm not, I don't consider it important deciding whether to be a Christian.
Well, of course you're aware that beliefs, the popularity of a belief does not ensure its truth. That those are different considerations. I myself, as you, I'm sure, are aware, am an agnostic, recognizing that there's no rational argument to prove the existence of God on the one hand, but also no rational argument to disprove the existence of God on the other, whereby I regard as theism and atheism as both equally rationally indefensible, since it's impossible to prove the case either way. I presume you regard your own beliefs in Christ and an afterlife as articles of faith.
Yes, there's no evidence for it. We believe it because God is telling us. And there are reasons to believe those signs. I wouldn't call it evidence. And I can give my reasons for believing and summon you to believe, but it's not a demand. I'm not going to criticize you if you don't believe.
Sure.
But I don't agree with the, there is an argument. There are two arguments for God's existence, and they're arguments, not proofs. But you can prove that human beings are embodied spirits. And it's kind of,
human beings are embodied spirits?
Spirits, yes.
Meaning you believe in a soul or something akin to a soul?
No, no, that's a mistake a lot of people make. We observe that all religions are telling us that we pay for our sins after we die. So this raises the question of what is sin and what is free will? And free will means we can move our hands about any way that we want. But if we lose our hands in an accident, we continue to exist. Our hands are something that we have. So it raises the question, what's the relationship between myself and my body? And the answer judged to be true by rational people and supported by the evidence is that it's a mystery. With the understanding that there are no mysteries in science. In science, there are only unanswered questions.
Well, I would take exception to that. I would suggest that it has to do with the conceptualization of freedom of the will, which is amenable to degrees insofar as it's a function of acting in accordance with our own preferences, free from coercion and constraint. In other words, we're not acting freely if we're being coerced to take an action we would prefer not to take and would not have taken absent the presence of that additional factor that interferes with our autonomy, roughly speaking, where autonomy really involves acting in accordance with your own motives, beliefs, ethics, abilities, and capabilities in the absence of compulsion and constraint. David, let me ask you this. Chance, our producer, is very keenly interested in these issues. Would you be okay for him to add a few comments of his own?
Oh, absolutely. That'd be great.
I think it would be great, too, especially since it's the 200th program we produced. Chance, would you like to make some opening comments?
Oh, I just kind of want to observe what you guys are talking about for a bit, but you know, I'm usually here in the background watching and eager to chime in, so I'll maybe send you a Skype if I've got some valid points to include. But I love paying attention, and religion is one of the subjects that I'm really recently diving into, and I've spent a lot of different religions, going across a lot of the different books, some of the apocryphal texts, a lot of the hidden texts. So I'm ready for this one too.
Excellent, 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 excellent. Well, David, would you dispute my characterization of freedom of the will, which is completely consistent with a causal account of our human being's place in the physical world?
Yes, I would dispute it.
Well, why don't you give us an outline or sketch of how you would approach it?
Well, we observe that we have free will. It's not a scientific observation. It comes from our ability to make ourselves a subject of our own knowledge. And it's clear we have it when we do something that takes a lot of willpower, like sticking to a diet. Or Kant's example was if you threaten to kill somebody, if he doesn't kill an innocent person. If you're in that situation, you have a difficult decision to make. It's clear that you're responsible for your actions, that we have free will. Now, this raises the question of what the relationship is between us. I already said that. So I consider it a mystery. And I find your comments sort of like, I have two slides which illustrate, they're both misunderstandings about or disagreements about free will. I think we should discuss those two slides.
The first we have them in the slide set here.
Yes, the first one is by
do you know the slide number? We can pull
them up. The slide number is it's number 18. It's the one by Thomas Nagel, Mind and Cosmos.
No, that's mine, Chance. That's not what David is alluding to. Let's see.
It's number.
Do you have the slide set, David, that I sent? Because you can then pick it out from that slide set.
Oh, there's a conflict between
I mean, can you look at the slide set, which might be on your desktop, and just tell me what number, and Jance will go there.
I'm looking at it. I can't. What I have in my notes is it's number 18. It's the quote from Thomas Nagel, Mind and Cosmos.
Well, let's go further down, because I've introduced a lot of slides there. Maybe 31, 32, somewhere in there, Chance. Go toward the – yeah, go – slow down. No, you went too far. Yeah, go back. Go back. Oh, wait, see that one. Go back that one. Acts of self-awareness? No, I think that's not it. Before that, I imagine, David.
No, that's not it. It's the one that begins traditional candidates. This is it. You just passed it.
Go back. There we go.
Okay, this is by Thomas Nagel, and he's an example of someone who understands the mind-body problem. As you can see from the title of his book, he's saying that materialism is almost certainly false. And then he sets forth the four possible theories, materialism, idealism, and dualism. Well, I agree with him that what I object to in this statement is his statement that dualism is a traditional point of view. Dualism is just a bright idea from a Descartes, and it's inconsistent with Christian doctrine. The point of view of Thomas Aquinas is his point of view, that it's some form of neutral monism. All we know is that a human being is a single unified being. We don't have any solution for the mind-body problem. Dualism is wrong because there's no evidence of a spiritual substance. And idealism is the idea that the material world is an illusion. That's wrong too. And materialism is wrong because there's no evidence for that either. The only thing,
David, but yeah, I don't like trading in some of those traditional positions because I've done a huge amount of work on all this, and it seems to me they're too much stereotyped. I mean, look, I just gave you an illustration of what I think is the proper meaning of freedom of the will. I'm not the only person to embrace it. Which is acting in accordance with your own preferences. I mean, anyone you know will tell you when they have been induced to do something they would just as soon they hadn't done, or when they're asked to do something they'd prefer not to do. And those are constraints on their free will, because their free will is the way they would act on the basis of their own motives, beliefs, ethics, abilities, and capabilities, independent of any form of coercion or constraint. I mean, maximal absence of free will is if you're bound and gagged, right? If you're in a white suit, when they come to take you off in a white suit, right, and you're all strapped down. I mean, there's a great limitation on your capacity for speech and action or motion in accordance with your own desires. So that inducement, sometimes we do things because we're offered benefits, money. Bribery often occurs because people are often offered money, and if they don't have great strength of character, they'll accept the bribe because that's consistent with their character. But I mean, I can't think of a situation in which we can't understand freedom of the will in the terms that I have characterized it, of acting in accordance with your own preferences.
But you admit that human beings have free will.
Yeah, sure, as I define it, absolutely. But we're frequently in circumstances where we're not as free to act as we would like to be. I mean, this can, you know, why do kids rebel against their parents? Because they're seeking to discipline them or constrain their options they won't let them stay up all night. If they could act in accordance with their preference, they'd stay up all night. Then they'd be very, very tired the next day, might not make it to school, might fall asleep in school. So the parent, in the interest of the child, constrains their free will for their own benefit. Eventually, of course, they reach an age of majority, 18, and the parents can no longer tell them what to do. And if you've been very, very lucky as a parent, you've induced enough character into your child that he'll act in ways that are basically appropriate in life and avoid ways that are not.
Well, I think the conflict between us is over the difference between science and metaphysics. The human mind is structured like a scientific method. At the lowest level, you have observations, which requires paying attention. And the next level is the level of inquiry, where we ask questions about what we observe. We want to know the cause of things, the relationship between things, and the unity between things. This requires intelligence, and extremely intelligent people invent theories to answer the questions. And that brings us to the third level, which is the level of reflective judgment. At this level, we gather the evidence and decide whether a theory is true or just probable. And the fourth level is deciding what to do with our bodies, which requires being responsible. Now, what this means to me is that there's two separate methods of inquiry. There's science and metaphysics. Science is questions about our sense observations. I see that the sky is blue, and I ask, why is the sky is blue? Why is the sky blue? But knowing the sky is blue means more than that light is going into my eyes and the signals are going to my brain. It means an awareness of it. So it raises the question, what is that awareness? And to me, it's a metaphysical question. It's not a scientific question.
Well, I would put all this rather differently. I'd say we experience sensations, and when we're able to subsume those sensations under concepts, that we have perceptions of things as certain kinds of things. When we don't have concepts to subsume them, we're in a state of unclarity, vagueness, uncertainty. Maybe we would think of it as being dealing with noise or images or what have you. That until we get a handle on what it is we're dealing with as a function of our conceptual apparatus, we may not be able to sort it out and figure out what we're dealing with.
Well, that's the where we disagree. I think you can sort it out. It's very clear in my mind the difference between metaphysical questions and scientific questions. It's two separate methods of inquiry, and I think what you're doing is assuming that there's only a scientific method of inquiry, or you're just mixing the two up.
Well, I most certainly reject the idea that human beings are scientific reasoning mechanisms unless they are given appropriate kinds of instruction to learn how to think. I mean, there is a kind of a primitive ability to put things together, but it seems to me in general it's not very well worked out, in that there are many methods of inquiry which could range from crystal ball gazing to tarot card reading to, you know, random guessing. Science is a systematic approach that involves four stages, as I see it, which are puzzlement. Something's going on you don't understand. Speculation. You seek to contemplate the alternative possible reasons why you might be experiencing what you're experiencing. Adaptation of the evidence to the hypotheses, where you figure which hypothesis, if it were true, would confer the highest probability on the available evidence. And finally, explanation, which entails accepting the best supported hypothesis in the tentative and fallible fashion of science when the evidence all tends in the same direction. A real simple example, David, would be at a crime scene where we come across a corpse that may have some bruising around the throat, but has no bullet holes, no knife wounds. If the hypothesis is what brought about the death of this corpse, then you could entertain the hypothesis that they were shot. But given that there are no bullet holes, the probability that they were, the likelihood they were shot, given there are no bullet holes, would be approximately zero. Similar for knife wounds. If there are no knife wounds, the probability they were, you know, the likelihood they were stabbed is approximately zero. Bruising around the neck, would suggest they might have been strangled. But of course, if further evidence comes in, say on the basis of an autopsy, and it turns out that while they had bruising on the around the neck, they actually died from being poisoned. When you've run toxicological and so forth kinds of tests, and we'd of course adapt our reasoning accordingly. Most people, I'm sorry to say, seem to me to trade on very, easily accessible forms of information like television, radio, newspapers. They seldom inquire whether reports they hear on television, for example, especially if they're often repeated, are or are not true. I mean, they not only are inclined to take for granted that what they're being told by the mass media is true, but they really are extremely limited in their ability to go about conducting investigation or research to determine whether or not they might be being misled, that maybe the stories they're being given are actually false. I mean, I've done a huge amount of work on Sandy Hook and on the Boston bombing, for example, and I can assure you that the reports that we've been given by the officials, the government, whether it's the Connecticut State Police, the governor of Connecticut, whether it's the Boston Police or the Boston Globe, those are not accurate reports. When you actually conduct the research into those cases, you'll discover actually the school was closed by 2008. There were no students there, and therefore no one for Adam Lanza to have shot, that it was a two-day FEMA drill. We actually have the manual for a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th, which I even put in a book I edited with 13 contributors, including a half a dozen PhD current or retired college professors. Now, I make the point simply to illustrate that, you know, most Americans really aren't very scientific in their reasoning and tend to accept what they're told by authorities they tend to accept as true. So there's a confusion in general between authority and truth. Authority is not truth, and truth should be the authority, but most Americans don't know how to sort it out. That's roughly how I'd put it.
So what do you think of Thomas Nagel's quote? Do you think he's being truthful?
Oh, well, from the point of view of our conversation here, he's being overly pedantic. I mean, you know, do we really need to go through defining materialism, idealism, dualism, materialism, neutral monism? I prefer to deal with the issue and take it apart and then figure out whether it does or does not comport with traditional views or not. I mean, I have done a great deal on the nature of mind, for example, and it turns out to be possible to develop a completely causal theory of mind, where minds are semiotic or sign-using systems that have the capacity to take something to stand for something else in some respect or other, which is developed out of the work on the nature of signs advanced by Charles S. Peirce, the only great American philosopher, although there are many who would claim to be.
Well, you admit that human beings have free will. Now, do you admit that the question, what's the relationship between myself and my body, is a good question?
Well, David, don't trade on an equivocation. When I say people have free will, I mean in a very specific sense that I elaborated already, to wit, acting in accordance with their preferences. But, of course, there can be various degrees of pressure that are applied to individuals so that freedom of the will is amenable to degrees. You can be in a situation where you're more or less free to act as you prefer, and others where you're not more or less free, or where you are more or less unfree to act as you prefer. Think of an individual who's been kidnapped and being held for ransom. I mean, their ability to act the way they would prefer to act is extremely limited because they're overpowered.
That's not my understanding of free will. That's not my understanding of
free will. Well, that's why I'm going back to make the point that we're not using the word the same way.
I think I agree. We're not using it the same way. I think you're using some kind of scientific analysis of free will. And for me, free will is a metaphysical observation. And I can comprehend free will, but I can't define it.
Yeah, Chance is telling me we have someone who would like to join us. by the name of Jim Angel. So I'm just telling Chance, sure. Well, Jim would be welcome to join. We're having a very unusual program tonight where we're simply having conversations. Chance, you might go back in terms of the slides to one about signs, you know, the triadic relationship I need to define, past the black box model. If you showed me those, I can probably, well, that's too far. That's going too far. Yeah, that, go back a little further, a couple more. Yeah, yeah, well, one more maybe. The nature of minds. Yeah, is there one more before that, the nature of signs? Okay, go back to the semiotic systems, the nature of minds. Yes. Is Jim joining us, by the way? Is Jim Angel joining us? Chance? Oh, Angel. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. Yeah, bring in Angel. That's fine. This is a fellow who's intermittently interviews me, David, and he's just very interested in all this. Are you acquainted with the concept of a sign as person intended it?
No, I'm not familiar with it at all.
Okay. Well, a sign in person's sense is a something that stands for something else in some respect or other. Take as a easily understood example, a red light at an intersection. If you know the rules of the road, you know the red light at the intersection stands for applying the brakes and coming to a complete halt and only proceeding when it turns green, right? So you got a something, in this case a red light, that stands for something, in this case applying the brakes and coming to a complete halt, for somebody, for those who know the rules of the road, and it's within a context. So, you know, even if you know the light is red, if your wife is going into labor and there's no other traffic around, you might easily run the light knowing full well that it stands for applying the brakes and coming to a complete halt because you have overriding reasons not to do what would be the normal thing to do under those circumstances.
But do you think
go ahead, David.
Do you think we could summarize the conflict we have about free will?
If you want to take a stab at it, go right ahead.
My point of view is that we can comprehend free will because we have it, but we can't define it. We can't answer the question, what's the relationship between myself and my body? And your point of view is more scientific. You want to go by observations. You want to analyze things that apply to animals as well as to human beings.
Well, that's true, because I certainly believe that the human mind didn't simply spring full-blown from the forehead of Athena, but it was a product of an evolutionary process where we have different types of minds as precursors in the evolutionary chain. Angel, come in and join us. Meet David. David, this is Activist Angel. You can call him Angel or...
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm wonderful. This is such a wonderful show. I'm honored to be. I just thought maybe I would have a question, but so far it's so fascinating. I just want to keep listening and learning. You guys are, wow. You know,
let me ask you this, David. Is your conception of free will one according to which actions are uncaused, as in the case, if you go back one slide here, or maybe two to the, right there, stop right there. See, I maintain, David, that all actions are human behaviors, in other words, motions and sounds we make that are motivated by factors that fall into these five different classes, motives, beliefs, ethics, abilities, and capabilities. And the reason for that symbol in the middle is it can be probabilistic. In other words, it can be that under the same circumstances, we might display one or another response within a certain range of responses, which might include, you know, you just met some woman and you want to impress her. Well, there might be different things you do to attempt to impress her, where which one you actually attempt may not be determined in the sense that in that exact situation, you'd always do the same thing, but you might do one or another within a certain range so that they have a certain probability of occurrence rather than certainty.
Well, you use the word causality. In my mind, there's three kinds of causality. When you talk about motives, there's such a thing as the final cause. If you spend 20 minutes washing your car, the final cause is having a clean car. Then you have metaphysical causality. Metaphysical causality occurs when a being begins to exist at some point in time, or a being that's a composition of two other beings, or in that case, you have a cause. Cause and effect in metaphysics occurs simultaneously. If the cause came before the effect, there would be a length of time when the cause wasn't causing anything and the effect wasn't being affected by anything. Then the third kind of causality is in science. In science, a causal system is one where the energy is constant. So in science, there's just a very weak connection between scientific causality and metaphysical causality and the causality of human action. Final causes. So when you say motives, to me, that means final causes. And beliefs.
Well, I would take exception to that, David, because motives are present in us now with respect to future attainments, the goals we want to accomplish. Your notion of a final cause, I take it, is Aristotelian, where Aristotle distinguished between the formal, the final, the material, and the efficient cause. Illustrated, for example, by a statue, say of Athena, if you like, which is created using a material as a material cause and a chisel as an efficient cause driven by a formal cause, the idea of creating this statue, but where, you know, lots of things can go wrong. I mean, the outcome may not actually be this flawless statue one had intended. It might have broken parts, what have you, that occurred in the process of seeking to create it. So I'm less of an Aristotelian than you would appear to be to me. Do you believe in retro causation? Do you think future states draw present states toward them?
Well, I never heard of that. I don't know what that is at all. But I believe in if you spend 20 minutes cleaning up your room, your final cause is having a clean room. And I don't think you can define final cause. And you seem to be using words which you use, then you can't define it. What is, you spoke of a motive. What was your definition of a motive?
Well, a motive is an element that's energized in a certain direction. It's like a vector in physics where you have energy in a certain direction. Motives are things that energize us to act in certain ways to accomplish our goals.
And what's your definition of a goal? My definition of a goal is the final cause.
Well, I eschew the Aristotelian framework. I mean, the goal is what we want to accomplish, and we often succeed, but we often fail. So
the disagreement between us is that I'm admitting that I can't define final cause and goals, but you're sort of slipping over the fact that it can't be defined. You're using the term.
I reject that. Even in Aristotelian terms, we can define it. I even gave you a perfectly good example of a statue in relation to the block of, say, marble as the material cause, the chisel as the efficient cause, the formal cause being the plan in mind to produce the statue. But causing the statue as the final cause, I'm pointing out that you can have slips in the process that you failed to realize your formal cause, the plan you envisioned for producing the statue. I don't think there's anything unintelligible about my characterization here, David.
No, you're speaking the same way I'm speaking. I'm saying that I'm using the term final cause, and you're using the term motive. The difference between I'm admitting.
Well, as I understand final causes, David, they would be, as it were, a future state that is drawing the present toward it as a form of retrocausation. So if you reject that, then I would be interested in what you mean by a final cause.
Well, by a final cause, I mean something you can't define. I know what a final cause is because I have free will and I do things with a goal and I can comprehend it because I have it, but I can't say what it is. I can't define it. It's a mystery.
See, the problem that has always bothered me about conceptions of free will, such as I infer you embrace, is they introduce an element of non-causality. In other words, you can be in a certain state of motives, beliefs, ethics, abilities, capabilities, and then your behavior could have no causal connection to those states in which you exist at the time. And that has always seemed to me, yes, I agree, unscientific. Even inexplicable, it makes behavior almost random in relation to its origins, which in each of our case includes all the motives, beliefs, ethics, abilities, and capabilities we instantiated at time T1 in relation to behavior we display at a time T2, which is equal to time T1 plus some delta, some temporal interval that yields T2.
The other slide I'd like to discuss is the quotation from a biology textbook by Neil Campbell. It comes right after the, I have it as number 21, but my labeling was wrong.
Well, I think you just didn't notice, you know, how many slides I'd added.
Keep going,
Chance.
Go
back.
Okay,
is this certain properties of the human brain distinguish our species from all other animals?
Right.
That's the one? Go for
it. That's the one. And this is an example of ignorance, in my opinion. He only understands two theories. He understands a mind-body duality and materialism. In fact, there's two other theories, as you can see from the quote from Nagel, there's idealism. And then the theory judged to be true by rational people is that it's a mystery. Mind-body duality is irrational. It's not, there's no evidence for it, and it's against Christian doctrine. Christian doctrine is that we inherit the stain of original sin from our parents in the sexual generation, and there's nothing miraculous about a human being being conceived. And the Apostles' Creed speaks of the resurrection of the body. It doesn't speak about the soul going to heaven.
And you believe in the resurrection of the body?
Yes, I believe in a perfect fulfillment of that our freedoms.
This is a return to life of an entity that's actually not alive, dead. So the typical sequence would be alive, then dead, then resurrected and alive again. Am I right?
So I believe that that our freedoms before God, and when we die, our past is somehow gathered up, and it becomes the defining moment in our lives. We can hope for salvation with fear and trembling. So it's something I hope for, and it's a belief. I believe it because God is telling us, and I have reasons for believing.
Yeah, but from my point of view, it's not clear you have any good reasons to believe it. I mean, you know, is it a testable proposition? Is it supposed to be possible for us to find cases of individuals who actually died and were resurrection outside of theological context where what we're accepting is an article of faith?
No, there's no evidence of life after death. I believe it for three reasons. The first is the historical Jesus. The second is the metaphysical argument for God's existence. And the third is that when you discuss it with people who don't believe, they don't discuss it in a reasonable way. And that's why I bring up the example of Neil Campbell. Neil Campbell only knows two theories of the mind, dualism, which is irrational, and materialism.
Yeah, but
they're both irrational.
But I'm not Neil Campbell, David, right? I'm Jim Fetzer, and I dare say I know more about these things than Neil Campbell. So to me, to attack Neil Campbell as though you thought that had any force against me would be a mistake, right?
Of course. And there's some I have another quotation from Sartre, which there are no mistakes in it all. I agree with 100%. And he's an atheist. But the reason I consider that a reason to believe is that he's an exception to the rule. He's an example of an atheist who discusses it in a reasonable way. But most atheists don't.
He's an atheist who discusses it in a reasonable way. Yes. Of course, from my point of view, atheism and theism are equally indefensible because you can no more prove that God does not exist than you can prove that God does exist. So,
well, I consider all three terms to be meaningless because there are arguments for God's existence. And it's perfectly reasonable to say the arguments are not persuasive. But atheists and agnostics don't say that. They say that.
Well, there are a lot of bad arguments for God's existence.
Yes,
I'm unaware of any good argument for God's existence. What do you think is an example of a good argument for God's existence, David?
A good argument is based on the observation that we have free will. So free will means we possess a center of action that is unified with respect to ourselves and different from other people. So you exist and I exist, but I am not you and you are not me. We're finite beings. But finite beings need a cause. So assuming or hoping that the universe is intelligible means there has to exist an infinite being. And in Western religions, we call the infinite being God.
Well, why does there have to be an infinite being, David?
Oh, there doesn't have to. It's based on the assumption or the hope that the universe is intelligible. If the universe contains only finite beings like us, that universe is less intelligible than a universe with finite beings and an infinite being.
I can't imagine any reason why the universe should be completely intelligible. I mean, it seems to me that's question begging to presume such a thing. Insofar as we're able to discover the laws of nature, of physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, and so forth, I think we're understanding and thereby rendering the world intelligible. Do you think there's a different or stronger sense of intelligibility than understanding the laws by virtue of which the world is governed?
Well, first of all, I said it was an argument, not a proof, and you refuted the argument. I mean, that's a perfectly legitimate objection to it. And
well, your sense of argument may be a bit weaker than mine. I mean, I was saying I don't know of any good argument for the existence of God. And you're suggesting if the world is to be completely intelligible, then there has to be some infinite entity that renders it such. I was offering a contrary position that there's no reason to presume that the universe is completely intelligible. And that insofar as we're able to grasp the laws of physics, of chemistry, of biology, of psychology, and so forth, in terms of which it functions or operates, that is a discovering intelligibility by virtue of the study of the laws of nature. Am I wrong?
No, you're 100% right. That's why I'm against the scientific arguments for God's existence. The Big Bang, for example, is evidence that God does not exist because it's evidence that the universe is not intelligible. After all, we're talking about 100 billion galaxies, each with 100 billion stars, the size of a tiny particle, an infinitesimally small particle. That's evidence that the universe is not intelligible. Hence, it's evidence that God does not exist. If you assume the universe is intelligible, or you're hoping that it's intelligible, then a universe with only finite beings is less intelligible than a universe with a finite beings and an infinite being that created the finite beings.
I'm not quite sure why you would take the Big Bang theory to render the world less intelligible. I mean, we could have an endless series of repetitions of Big Bangs, expansions, reaching a limit, contractions, big crunches, another Big Bang, expansion, reaching a limit, contraction, big crunches, where you know, there are laws that govern the periodicity of universes in the way I just described.
There's no
wouldn't that make it intelligible if we understood that there could be a series of big bangs that are followed by a succession of expansion and contractions?
If there's evidence supporting that theory, that would make the universe more intelligible. And that would be add to our reasons for saying God existed. But that this state of affairs now is that there's the big bounce theory and all those other theories, there's no evidence for it.
No evidence. Are you implying there's no evidence for the concept of an expanding universe?
Oh, yeah. We know that the universe is expanding, and we know that the universe began to exist 13.7 billion years ago as a tiny particle. That was confirmed when we discovered the background radiation when hydrogen atoms were formed from the binding of the protons and the electrons, called cosmic background radiation.
Would there be an extent to which the universe, having expanded that far, that the force of gravity would bring about a contraction?
That's a theory, but there's no evidence that's called the big bounce theory, and there's no evidence for it. It's just a theory.
Well, but David, theories before they're empirically tested and confirmed or falsified, I mean, there's a role in scientific reasoning for theories. Remember, on my characterization, we begin with puzzlement, something we don't understand. We're talking about an example here. Speculation, what are the alternative possible explanations that might apply? An adaptation, where we have to test out the theory in relation to the available evidence and determine which among them confers the highest probability on the available evidence. I mean, even if we're at an early stage in speculating, theorizing, explaining the origin of the universe, that wouldn't make it an unscientific project per se, would it?
No. I mean, everything you're saying is very scientific. It's a scientist's job to come up with theories that explain the Big Bang, the origin of life, and evolution. That's your job. And the inability of a scientist to do that is, as I said, is evidence that the universe is not intelligible, and it's evidence that God does not exist. I mean, we're in agreement that using the unsolved scientific problems to argue that God did it is irrational.
Tell me again, Chance was asking about the death and resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. Do you have any evidence to support that?
Well, the resurrection of Jesus is an historical event. The followers of Jesus disbanded after he was crucified in fear and discouragement. But then they renewed their fellowship within a few years, and they swore up and down that Jesus appeared to them, and they founded Christianity. I mean, all historians agree that this happened. This was the historical event.
Well, David, aren't we basing this on, you know, reports that might or might not be true? I mean, mightn't it be the case that the story of the resurrection is symbolic, that Jesus gave his life to save humanity, and that we should appreciate that because of the sacrifice he made, we're all in the position of benefit?
No, my understanding is that all historians agree that the followers of Jesus swore up and down that he appeared to them, and they all agree that that they started Christianity. That's an historical event. Now
Yeah, but David, everything that happens everywhere all the time is an historical event. The question becomes, about this one, it would be such an obvious violation of the laws of biology that forms of life, once dead, do not resurrect, do not come back to life. I mean, isn't that the problem with the whole story of the death and resurrection of Jesus?
No, I don't follow. It's you're confusing faith with reason. The resurrection of Jesus is both an object of faith and an historical event. So as an historical event, it refers to the renewed fellowship of the followers of Jesus. And as an object of faith, it means that Jesus is alive in a new life with God. So you're confusing two different things. I believe that Jesus is alive, and the resurrection of Jesus as an historical event is just one of the reasons. The other reason is the fact that all religions say that believe in life after death, and the argument for God's existence. And the other reason, as I already mentioned, was that people who don't believe don't discuss it in a reasonable way, with the exception of Jean-Paul Sartre. I have a quote from Jean-Paul Sartre, where he discusses the Christianity in a reasonable way.
Maybe David, would you agree that laws of nature cannot be violated and cannot be changed?
Absolutely.
So if we have an event like the death of a human being, assuming he was in fact dead, didn't merely simply appear to be dead, but actually was dead,
right,
his resurrection would be a violation of the laws of biology? Is that not the case?
No. The followers of Jesus had a religious experience. They swore up and down that Jesus appeared to them.
I'm sure you're familiar with the observation of David Hume, who said that it must be more improbable that these reports be false than it is improbable that the laws of, in this case, biology be violated. But if the laws of biology can't be violated and can't be changed, it would seem that it has to be more probable that those reports are mistaken than it is that the laws of biology were violated.
What reports, I mean, are you disagreeing that the followers of Jesus renewed their fellowship and started Christianity?
I'm denying that anyone can die and then come back to life. If they're really dead, they cannot come back to life. It's a law of biology.
Yes, and there's no evidence that somebody can come back to life. And I'm giving you my reasons. I've already given them for believing in life after death. The historical Jesus, the argument for God's existence, and then people who don't believe don't discuss it in a reasonable way.
I don't know, David. I'm having a hard time with this. I mean, what? Those are supposed to be good reasons for...
No, I'm not saying they're good reasons. If they were good reasons, they'd be evidence. I'm distinguishing between faith and reason. In reason, you have evidence supporting what you believe. In faith, you believe something because God is telling you, and you have reasons to believe. It's not good reasons or bad reasons. Well, I guess you could say there are good reasons and bad reasons, but all of my reasons are good. One of my reasons is the historical event of the resurrection of Jesus. And atheists admit, if you've heard of the Jesus seminar, it's a bunch of atheists, and they agree that Jesus rose from the dead within 3 or 4 years of the crucifixion. They agree with you. There's no such thing as a dead body coming alive. But they accepted the historical fact that the followers of Jesus renewed their fellowship and swore up and down that Jesus appeared to them. You can see with
people swear to things all the time, David, and that unfortunately doesn't make them true. So I'm sure you'd grant that point. It sounds to me as though you're suggesting that you have reasons for your belief in a life after death that are predicated on other articles of faith, such as that the historical Jesus died and was resurrected, that his followers swore that he had died and been resurrected, and the origins of Christianity, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, most of us would not have a problem talking about the origin of Christianity as having occurred somewhere around. Do you have a specific date, or is it going to be 0 AD, or a little later, or a little earlier?
Resurrection? Well, I mean, maybe you're thinking that I'm criticizing you for not believing in life after death. I'm not criticizing at all. All I'm doing is telling you that I believe in life after death, and I'm giving you my reasons. That's it.
That's okay. I'm just asking whether they're good reasons that ought to count for anybody else rather than subjective ones that matter for you, but don't therefore matter equally to others who do not share those beliefs.
All my reasons are good. And a lot of
people, they're good for you, David. I'm not disputing that you believe these things based on the reasons you give. That appears to be evident from your protestation thereof. I mean, I'm willing to accept you believe those things. The question is, are there any good reasons for you to believe those things?
I gave you my, I didn't call them good. I gave you all of my reasons, and they're better than other people's reasons. For instance, a lot of people have bad reasons. For example, they think that it's an historical fact that the tomb was empty in after 3 days.
David, let me ask you this question. Why does life after death matter? Why should anyone care whether there's life after death?
Because it makes life meaningful. It means your purpose in life is to get to heaven. And it means you're compensated for with whatever suffering you've had to put up with in your life. I haven't had much suffering, but other people have. And then it gives you a goal and a purpose. It means that life has meaning.
I think it was Karl Marx who observed that, you know, religion is a way of pacifying working people to accept suffering in this life in the expectation of some kind of compensation in the next, even though there is no next life.
Yes, that's I agree
with you. Know, doesn't that just appear to be a convenient belief for the exploiters of humanity to induce among the exploited so they won't become unnecessarily restless and rise up to, say, kill those who are their captors?
Well, that's consistent with my my point of view. And that's why I like the quotation from John Paul Sartre. Sartre admits in the quotation that man is a useless passion. He doesn't believe in life after death. And he... So he says, man is a useless passion. Life has no meaning if it ends in the grave.
I don't understand that. It seems to me life has all kinds of meaning. Its meaning derives from accomplishing things in life, dealing fairly with your friends, promoting the interests of your allies, you know, having a loving, supportive relationship, raising children, publishing books, articles, whatever. You know, accomplishing goals in the amount of time you have, the opportunity to do it, that seems to me to give life all the meaning it could require.
Well, yes, I mean, you can have a meaningful work life and a meaningful family life, but it only makes sense to talk about having a meaningful life if you believe in life after death.
I feel my life has been very meaningful, and it's got nothing to do with a life after death. Angel, I know you'd like to make a comment.
I'm fascinated. You guys are just fascinating to listen to. I would ask about in metaphysics there, David, because at least several different instances, not just, you know, Einstein's relativity theory, but Bell's theorem and even Schrodinger and Heisenberg, we get to a place where somewhere in physics, time is not present. And it reminds me of what Jim was saying with retrocausation. And I wonder if you could, you know, if there isn't any time for spirit and it was only what, an illusion here? What's your thought on the idea of time and how it fits in to your thinking?
Well, the concept of space comes about by picturing a room and creating the image in your mind of the room and then supposing that the walls and the ceilings are not longer there. Now, the concept of time comes about by looking at a clock and remembering what the clock said 5 minutes ago. Now, this is not the same as the concept of space and time in physics. In physics, space and time is a variable, and it's more complex and difficult than that.
David, we're at the approximate place to take a break. I know that Chance would like to join us after the break. Is that agreeable with you?
Yeah, sure.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, David Romer. We're talking about issues related to religion and science on the occasion of the 200th broadcast of The Real Deal on the Media Broadcasting Center, where after the break we'll be joined by Chance George. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, inviting you to stand by.
Moonrock Books. We're a group of scholars, experts, and authors who feel the world really needs saving. and that resisting the American Empire is the right thing to do. People are starved for truth. They are given lies. They subsist on lies, but it's not really living. People are not watching TV news. They're ceasing to read newspapers, too, because they know by now they will not find it there. The biggest battle being fought anywhere is with information. If the people can receive the truth, they will do the right thing. We are publishing the truth about Sandy Hook, about the Boston bombing, about the moon landings, about the Holocaust, and much, much more. The truth. It falls upon us to fight the Empire and save the world. Join us, Moonrock Books.
Less than 3% of you people read books, but less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone so they'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
Well, we can't hear him.
There we go. Hi, welcome back to The Real Deal. I'm Activist Angel. Unfortunately, I'm here because Jim's audio just went out. So I do have an interesting question for you, David. Where do miracles fit in? I'm a student of a set of books called A Course in Miracles. I do believe in the vertical reorganization of everything, space, time, and the concept of Christ's miracles. How does that fit into the scientific metaphysics that you were talking about?
Well, miracles are reasons to believe in revelation. They're signs. So an example of a sign would be the Shroud of Turin. The best explanation for it is that it was made by Gnostics in the first or second century using a crucified victim and methods that have been lost to history. But this is also a sign that Jesus is alive because it's such an unusual thing. It's a reason to believe.
And when Jesus said, all these things I do, ye can do and more, then we could walk on water, we could turn water into wine, you know, loaves and fishes, we have all those powers too?
Well, it's an historical fact that Jesus was an exorcist and a healer.
Uh-huh.
About those other types of miracles, the water into wine, I don't know.
Okay. You're not sure about those, so you're not a biblical literalist then?
No. The historical Jesus to me was a Jewish prophet who preached the coming of the kingdom of God.
Uh-huh.
He was an exorcist and a healer. And after the crucifixion, his followers disbanded in fear, and then they renewed their fellowship and swore up and down that Jesus appeared to them. They had a religious experience. And that they went on to found Christianity. And you can say it's an historical fact that Jesus saved mankind from meaning. Oh, you cut off again.
Me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me there, David?
I can hear you now.
Okay, great. Oh, no, I was my son came in, and I don't think they expected me to be covering his host for a moment. But I host another show that Jim was on today, as a matter of fact. So what is your context? I mean, did you explain that? And I might admit, I missed the first 10 minutes of the show. You're not a biblical Christian, literal biblical Christian, but where does it come from?
Well, I believe in I'm a Catholic, so I go along with the Catholic doctrine, and the Catholic Church teaches that that the Bible is divinely inspired. But I'm not interested in promoting Catholicism against the other world religions. I'm just interested in persuading people that there's life after death. And the resurrection of Jesus and the fact that Jesus saved mankind from meaning is reasons to believe. And this is where we have a conflict between me and James Fetcher. I consider it an historical fact that Jesus saved mankind from meaning. Because he taught us that our purpose in life is to serve God in this world in order to be with him in the next, not to show any disrespect for the Eastern religions.
Yeah.
And Mr. Jim doesn't agree with us. He thinks that life has meaning because we can enjoy ourselves and have a good time of life.
Well, so what parts of the biblical record do you think are historically factual? Jesus' words, but not necessarily some of the miracles? How do you distinguish between what's factual and what's maybe made up by the Council of Nicaea or whatever?
You distinguish by reading what atheists and believers agree about with regard to Jesus. So, for example, a lot of religious people think that Jesus rose from the dead, as it says in the Gospels, within 3 days on Sunday.
Yeah.
But atheistic scholars just put it, aren't able to focus in on that time. They say it happened within a few years.
Uh-huh.
So my understanding of the historical Jesus is that the resurrection happened within a few years.
Within a few years. So that transcends the law, generally accepted laws of biology and physics, as Jim was talking about, doesn't it?
No.
If you're being resurrected?
Well, people have religious experiences. I mean,
Paul. Yeah, I have.
They fell off his horse, and he had a religious experience. Jesus appeared to him. In fact, he described it as a spiritual body. He didn't say he saw the body of Jesus. He described it as a spiritual body.
Something beyond this.
Yeah. He was saying he had a religious experience. So that's how I view the resurrection as an historical event. But as I said, the resurrection is also an object of faith. So as an object of faith, we believe that Jesus is actually alive in a new life with God.
Sure. And is he a separate entity from us? I mean, what about the new religion that we're all part of God and experiencing it? And Jesus is an evolutionary elder brother or a cleaner facet of the giant crystal. We're separate from him and separate from God?
That's a good question. The metaphysical argument for God's existence is based on the idea that we're finite beings. And a finite being is a composition of essence and existence. And a finite being's essence limits its existence. Whereas God is a pure act of existence. In other words, an infinite being. And the significance of the metaphysical argument is that it supports the Bible. The Bible says that when God appeared to Moses, he said, "I am who I am." The Jewish name of God is Yahweh, which means "I am who I am." In other words, the Jewish Bible sort of implies that God is a pure act of existence. And that's a sign. That's another reason to believe in the Bible, that the Bible is the word of God. Because the Jewish authors of the Old Testament didn't know anything about essence and existence.
Yeah. How about on one of the fundamental differences between many of the different religions? Was our spirit in existence before we were born on this earth and joined the physical body? Or did it begin at you and I originated at our very conception? We didn't have an existence as an entity prior to this life. Like the Mormons, for instance, believe that we already are existence. But your Catholicism, does that define that for you?
Yes. According to the Catholic faith, we inherit the stain of original sin from our parents through sexual generation.
Uh-huh.
So the whole idea that there's some kind of spirit that's infused into us at all is not consistent with Catholic doctrine.
So you and I began as beings at the moment we were born, conceived on this earth now. We didn't have a life before that. Yeah.
The adoption of original sin.
And when we go to the next life, what happens then? Do we continue to learn and grow, or is it what? Oh, I hear Jim. Okay. Do we continue to learn and grow, or is that kind of a fine? This is it. This is the only life we get.
Well, it's we believe it's a perfect fulfillment based on our human experiences. So we feel that we believe that we have bodies because our human experiences has dealings with other people. I mean, can't imagine what it's like to feel a perfect fulfillment without our bodies. So what we know is that it's some kind of perfect fulfillment based on human experience.
Go ahead. Glad I was here, Jim. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, I'm plugged back in. Miracle.
Wonder of wonder.
David, let me ask you a question about polytheism. If somebody were to believe there are many gods, maybe one for each season, summer, fall, winter, spring, each emotion, anger, fear, apprehension, what have you, could you show that they were wrong?
Well, the argument for God's existence is the one I just said, and there can only be one God. Because God is an infinite being, a pure act of existence, so it can't be true.
Well, but suppose somebody doesn't believe that, you know, they don't buy into your argument. Could you show they were wrong? I mean, you could only say they're wrong in terms of the premises I accept, which imply that there is only one God who is infinite, right?
No, you can't. If someone says that the argument for God's existence is doesn't have content, or that it's contradictory, or that it's not persuasive, you can't dispute that. That's a perfectly legitimate response to the argument for God's existence. The important thing is to understand the argument. So I have no, that's one of the things I have in the quote from Sartre. Sartre says that the concept of God is contradictory. And he understands the argument for God's existence. That's the important thing, to understand it, not to make decisions about it. Because for one thing, the only decision you have to make is whether there's life after death. But there's no evidence for life after death. We know there's life after death because God is telling us. So I don't see any need to make a separate decision about God's existence.
So you don't see that as a circular argument, that there's life after death because God tells us, but we know there is a God is because there's life after death? Am I missing something?
Yes. There's an argument for God's existence, and that raises the possibility that God will communicate with us and tell us that there's life after death.
By the way, Chance has been very patient. He's got comments he wants to add. Chance, please do join the discussion.
Okay, I think I got all my audio queued up. I just got a couple extra mute buttons for myself to go on air. Basically, my first comment and question would be more of the resurrection and the Jesus that you were talking about earlier. Now, if we take any kind of word of man, whether it be the Bible, the Quran, any different book that was written by man, it is possible corrupt. If we hear a story about 9/11, it could be corrupt. If we hear about, you know, the Holocaust, something could be written, you know, all history is written by the victors, basically. So if we think that what comes out of the book could be, you know, set in stone, there's a possibility that it's corrupted. We would have to almost look at what is uncorruptible. And one of the things that I think is uncorruptible would be astrology or the stars, the different planetary alignments. There is no elite power that I know or any banking consortium that's powerful enough to move the stars. So when I look at the story of the stars, and I'm glad that you brought up the Lamb, if we look at the Zodiac and astrology or astrotheology, which is the God show, and taking the story of the stars, you would notice that the Son of God, which I agree, did die on the cross, but the cross that I'd like to call it is the center of the Zodiac, which is your summer solstice and your equinox, where your equinox and your solstice meet in a circle is a cross. And now the Son of God, which you guys in different religions are calling the S-O-N of God, I think is a mistranslation. It's more the Son of God, the S-U-N, God's Son. So I believe that religion is right when they say Jesus is the risen Savior. Of course the Son itself, the entity, the ball, the gas giant there is the Son. Okay, if the Son didn't come up in the morning, the entire planet would die. So God's Son is our risen Savior, the light of the world. Okay, so the Son itself, during the summer days, we have longer and longer days, and during the winter we have shorter and shorter days. And as a story of the stars that's unmovable, we can see the actual star or the sun moving across the horizon in different degrees, and it reaches its lowest point on the horizon on December 21st, which is the winter solstice, which is where it dies on the Southern Cross. Now the sun, you can even talk to any kind of NASA or satellite imagery, it stays dead for 3 days, or it appears to move up or down on the horizon no greater for 3 days, until on the third day, on December 25th, it begins to ascend and move up 1 degree, actually resurrecting. So it is true that the Son, or the Son of God, died on the cross, the equinox and the solstice, was dead for 3 days, and resurrected. This is a solar cycle that we see every single year, and the full ascension to this culminates on the Easter holiday. So when the spring finally pops and the illumination of the wonder of the sun finally comes to its full resurrection, we celebrate this in Easter. And this is the story of the secular metaphor that basically is told through the sun cycle, and this is repeated through every major religion in history. So I just to me, I kind of believe the story of the stars to be more of an unrefutable and uncorruptible message, whereas we're taking the word of a book at kind of face value, when all of us know in alternative thinking that some of the books could be corrupted. Does any of that make sense, or what is your comment on the fact that every religion, including Jesus, basically follows some sort of astro theology or movement of the stars in the heavens?
Well, I never heard of that before. It sounds like an argument in favor of religious faith. There's a big coincidence between Christianity and astrology.
No. What I'm saying is when I'm hearing man create a story of Jesus, of Satan, of the devil, of worship, of good and evil. Well, we look at the original word Satan in Hebrew, and it is not Satan. It was a Satan. And a Satan is just an opposite or an opposer in a court. So, of course, the sun, or the Son of God, the light of the world, the risen Savior, the actual sunshine that I'm talking, I see every day, the opposite of that would be dark, would be evil. So if good and God, the sunshine is good to all of ancient man and to people today. In fact, it's actually healthy. I was out in the sun today and it felt great. So the opposite of that good would be evil, which is just dark, which is nighttime. So you've got God or good, you know, add one O to God, you have good. The Satan, the Hebrew Satan, or the opposer to good, is evil. Or actually just evil with a D would be devil. So to me, it just seems that you're taking something that happens in the sky that ancient man had no way to actually put into words without coming up with these great metaphors. So I'm saying the Bible is the greatest story ever told, but it's just that, a story.
Of course.
It's not true.
Historians agree about the historical Jesus.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is your lamb that you're talking about, if you take the zodiac, the year that the zodiac ended in the sign of the lamb or the sign of the ram was 325, which is the end of that particular sign, and it starts the new sign. The new sign was the sign of Pisces. So the Son of God, or the Lamb of God that died on the cross, then born the fishermen, the two fish, which is the exact time, 325, that the Council of Nicaea met and they came up with all of Christianity. So is it more common sense that the people were relating what they saw in the heavens directly above them, which was the sign of the stars dying on the cross, the Lamb of God, the Lord's risen Savior, was then being resurrected as this new Jesus figure, which, by the way, 2,000 years ago, they did not have the letter J, so this Jesus is kind of a new entity that's been brought along ever since then. And then you mentioned earlier that it was actually Yahweh or the Tetragrammaton, and all of that, the Tetragrammaton used to be Atom. Or Amen, which is actually Amen. Amen Ra, an ancient sun god, sun worship. So it's more like everything that we're seeing is wide speculation and this great weird belief that you have to have if you're relating it to a religious person, someone that actually died, or in a faith-based value. Whereas if you're doing this from a sign of the stars, astrotheology, the movement of the heavens, the great solar cycle, which I could get into the math of how all that works out, and it's something that happens over and over, repeatable scientific process, it just makes more sense looking up at the stars. There's been great cultures such as the Mayans and all that who have recorded the star movements for thousands of years in advance. It just blows me away with the amount of information on available to the entire planet of humanity that we could still have faith in something. Anyone in this conversation knows that if you were going to a court of law on a mass murder charge and you just had faith that you're going to get through this trial, you're probably going to jail. You wouldn't want to believe. You would want to know. And I can know the story of all of the different entities, but it's all through astrotheology. It has nothing to do with a belief system and faith. I'm just dumbfounded.
Chance, there's one more thing you forgot to mention, that those symbols are found in so many, everything from the 12 apostles, just like the 12 signs of the zodiac, the Lamb of God, the risen sun, the resurrection, the Virgin Mary out of the Virgo cluster. Those, that story is ubiquitous long before the Jesus story came along and sort of took those elements to it.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Chance is suggesting that the Christian story is a kind of a verbal summary of celestial phenomena that represents a kind of a record of a cumulative knowledge about the heavens and the relationship between major components thereof that's presented, as it were, in the form of a fable about a man who actually represents the sun. Is that right, Chance?
That's exactly correct. It's a metaphor. It's a great metaphorical story of the historic movement of the celestial beings, the original Septillian history, the five planets and the sun and the moon. All of that in the great metaphor. We all know about the Earth's axis, and I could explain all of that, how it relates. It's mathematics.
Because the ancient Babylonians and the Mesopotamians had similar parables about the heavens that were intended to encapsulate astronomical information, very much on the order you're describing here and attributing to Christianity.
Yeah, actually, every single major religion, you can look at all of them, go back, every religion of the book, for sure, all the book religions, Judaism, Islamic, Christianity, we can look at the Sumerian tablets, we can look at the Egyptian Book of the Dead, we can look at any of the apocryphal books, the Book of Enoch, all of this stuff all brings back to not only different tales of different gods coming down and men being seated and different stories like that, but also of the sun worship. That's why you have the different seven wonders of the world, and they all relate to the seven different original planets, or the five original planets that the human eye could see, and the sun and the moon. This is all just giant metaphors that men has related, and can go through the original seven wonders of the world. They're all corresponding to all the planets, and it's all has math behind it. It has science. It's all provable things that you can duplicate and replicate.
If you understand them, if you interpret them correctly.
But it's the Jewish religion which taught that God created the universe from nothing. The other religions all said that there was pre-existing materials of some sort. So a reason to believe in the Bible.
Talking about in the beginning was the Word?
Yes, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was the concept of God, of the world in God's mind. So the Big Bang is it's evidence that God does not exist, because it's evidence that the universe is not intelligible. But the Big Bang is a reason to believe in the Bible.
But when they're saying
the Bible God created the universe from nothing.
When they're saying in the beginning and God there at the beginning, they're actually Hebrew translation says Elohim, and the Elohim is plural. It's the gods.
The Jewish people used to be polytheistic.
Yeah, and their entire Jewish Kabbalah is from the Tree of Life. And the Tree of Life, it has the 10 different houses in it, which are corresponding to the 10 houses of the Zodiac, the Kabbalah, and the entire religion behind it, and all of that, it's all astrotheology if you get off of the book worship and move to the stars. I don't know if you've looked at that.
John's Gospel saying that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And the Word was the concept of the universe in God's mind. And then God created the universe. That's a specifically Jewish-Christian thing.
I don't know if anyone else wanted to jump in. I just wanted to pull up a couple.
Oh, I'm glad. I thought it was fascinating, Chance. I wanted you to continue.
Yeah. Give me 1 minute to pull up I've got some other research here on the actual Genesis, which to me, Genesis actually is more of a report of the gene Isis, the genes of Isis, or the original man, sun god, worship. I'll get back to that and just, I gotta look up some of my notes and then I'll get right back in. Sure. So you guys take over.
A couple things. One, Peter Joseph's documentary Zeitgeist has an amazing representation of what Chance is talking about. And I think part of the suggestion there is that when the Council of Nicaea wanted to create Christianity, they took some of the parts of Mithra and the other gods and the pagan gods that come before them and sort of incorporated them. And of course, you have to switch around in this thinking, Easter and Christmas, because it's actually the death and resurrection is the sun stopping in its southern movement for 3 days on December 22nd, and then on the 25th, beginning its process back forward again. And Easter is actually so that's the death, and the birth would be Easter, would be the time of the lambs, when it was safe to travel, and you know there were lambs, you know, lambs are born in springtime, so it switches around astrologically.
Let me ask you a question, Angel. Do you agree that human beings are embodied spirits?
Yes, I think that I'm something more than this body. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, good for you.
Yeah. And how about you, Jim? Are you more than just this body? Do you know?
Well, I'm an animated person. I have a personality. I have character. I have various beliefs, ethics, abilities, capabilities. But in the end, I mean, you have your body, and then there's what you do with it. It's like you have a brain, but the mind is the mental capabilities that attach to that brain. And we know if brains are damaged, many of those mental capabilities are lost, sometimes forever. But that, you know, you have to think in terms of structure and function, you know, what you can do with your life, you know, what gives it meaning is all the meaningful relationships you have with other people. And in terms of accomplishing your goals and making contributions to humanity, such as maybe fall within your capability.
But do you go on after, do something fundamental about you go on after this body passes away? What do you think?
No.
No. Really? Wow. Okay. See, I'm halfway between the two of you. It's funny.
I accept my fate, dust unto dust. You know, I mean, when the end comes, that is the end. There is nothing more.
Yeah, I've had solid communication from the other side. You're a virtual, this is a virtual reality suit, and you're a being playing it. Sure, the robot may break a little bit, and then you can't move some certain part of it, but your spirit's more than just Angel. This mind and this body.
Well, I'm just ecstatic to have all these contributions from you and David and Chance alike. I mean, I think it's sensational, especially on the occasion of the
Angel. 200th
broadcast of The Real Deal.
Bravo!
Angel, I just wanted to make a comment. When you were talking about having some sort of connection to a divinity, whether it be God, Yahweh, the universe itself, I just wanted to take my take on that. And this goes back to a lot of the ancient societies and the mystery schools have actually gone through this, that what you and I are living in, our mind that we're daily going through, is our conscious mind. That if you're, you know, looking at this as a computer, which is kind of an easy analogy, that'd be kind of like an application. So we've got an app on a computer. It's aware of itself, everything that's involved in the app. Now, the other divide of that is the subconscious mind that we all know picks up messages, takes in way more information that we all talk about. That would be more like your operating system on your computer. It's always running. It knows all the functions that are going on. It's aware of all its stuff. It's programmed like that. But what you're talking about is that connection that you're talking about to the universe, the connective, the collective unconscious, is actually the internet. That would be the worldwide collective data of conscious information. So when you die, or this is just my belief system, and it's actually backed up by a lot of stuff, when you die, the body, so like we've all had a computer desktop that's died, you've been logged in as Angel on all your profiles, your desktop dies, you're like, this is a piece of junk, you go down to your local store, you get a brand new body, or a PC, computer, you log in to your internet connection, you get back onto where you were, and you could still be everything that you just were, but in a new form. Science says you cannot create or destroy, only transfer energy. So I don't believe, like, that'd be my one disagreement with Jim here, is that you're dead. I believe that you go on, you do the reincarnation, you come back, you don't go on to a heaven, because of what I was saying about the stars and all that. You know, where would you actually go? But I think that the connection you're talking about, when you're talking, you actually got your conscious mind not to hear the internet, because your application could never hear the internet. You are finally getting a bridge in the middle of your mind to be able to talk to your subconscious, and your subconscious has accessed that information that's on the internet. So I think that's your connection to divinity. And if you look at many tarot cards, how they perceive this information, and many of the ancient mystery schools, they all talk about the connection to the collective unconscious, but you have to go through your subconscious mind, which is your access. All the information's here and available. We just have to be able to tap into it.
Isn't that one of the coolest things you guys have ever heard? That's so cool.
And if all of your data streams were wiped clean, Chance, then you would no longer exist.
Right? Well, I think that when you come back, this is what a lot of the people are talking about, reincarnation. When you go through the birth canal, the reborn into this lifetime, that is when you forget everything that's happened in the last one. So if you lived a life full of envy, hate, greed, and all of that, you have to come back and you have to redo that and just keep doing this until you ascend to this universal information, this consciousness.
That's a very Platonic concept to introduce the idea of knowledge as recollection. So you're supposed to be born knowing everything or possess all knowledge before your birth, but then you forget it and have to gradually recollect it, as David undoubtedly
Can I just share with you a really weird story that now this has been verified. It sounds really weird, but just with the reincarnation thing and being able to remember what you past knew. So a small child was drawing pictures about a Japanese kamikaze plane, or a Japanese plane going down into the ocean, crashing and dying, and the parents were really kind of disturbed that their small child was drawing these pictures. And when he kept drawing these pictures, the parents, you know, started quizzing. Well, what is this? And he says, this is me. I died here. And he's giving a name and all that. And he was talking about all this Japanese name and all this stuff. And basically the dad kind of got interested, went on the internet. He tracked down a World War II flight that went down into the ocean with the same name of the person that the son was talking about. They actually traveled to Japan, went out on boats using the boy's drawings, using different recollections from what the son was talking about, and found the plane of this Japanese World War II fighter that was lost from Japan, and was able to finally put to rest the family in Japan who was searching for this lost relative. And he was actually saying that was his reincarnation, and the boy remembered, and he pointed it out. So, I mean, if all of it's complete BS, how does little things like that happen?
How was his Japanese, Chance?
I don't think his Japanese was very good, but I know that it's just another case that kind of, you know, I think that people latch on to religion because it gives you something to hope for after death. You're not just the eternal end, but at the same point in time,
to tolerate the injustices during this life, that's for certain.
Yeah, but then does that mean, Jim, does that mean, could maybe your guest say, does God hate amputees then?
Does God hate amputees?
Yeah, he's the only people on the planet who don't get their prayers ever answered. If people can pray to God that they want a better job, and when they finally get a job, they attribute that to, oh, Jesus Christ, they prayed to him, and I said amen, and I was given my gift of my new job, or you pray to have a new marriage and a better life, and you get that new marriage, and you just, you know, that was God. But every single amputee in the history of all amputees has always prayed for that spontaneous regrowth of any kind of leg or arm, and it's never happened in history. So, I mean, does he just hate amputees and he will never grant them their wish, or is it just not actually a person? So, I mean,
I don't know, Chance. I've seen some movies where you had the regrowth of these limbs by some pretty weird creatures.
Yeah, they might be able to do that sometime soon. You know, the reincarnation thing is explainable in your interesting analogy, Chance, about the computers. You guys, can I give you a different analogy on that same subject? So when I was 27, my girlfriend was killed in a car accident, and she appeared to me in my room. Now, anyone would call it a dream, but she and I used to go to channeling sessions, so we were really into this stuff. So when she died, she came and she said, because we had sort of were into it, it wouldn't frighten me for her to tell me exactly what happened when she died. And she told me exactly what happened when she died. She said that the universe is set up as microcosms and macrocosms. And in my mind, the image she put was a sun with planets going around it being a macrocosm and an atom with electrons going out and being a microcosm. See, it's set up like the universe
is
set up that way.
As above, so below.
As above, so below.
Exactly.
She said that dying was a macrocosm of dreaming. And she said the difference was that this life is a co-created dream. And that you and Chance and I are all friends on another level. And we all went to sleep together. This was before virtual reality, or she might have explained it that way, right? This was in 88. So, we all went to sleep together and co-created this dream. She told me her experience was she woke up, saw me sleeping in the other bed. And again, this is all analogous, right? She went over to me, patted my forehead, kissed my forehead, told me she loved me. And to her, I rolled over a little bit and said, I'm going to sleep a little bit longer. And that translated to me as me seeing her in my room with my body sitting on the bed, the only out-of-body-ish experience I've ever had. And it just made such perfect sense to me that that's how things operated, that from then on I was a mystic, right?
Now, Chad mentioned the problem of evil. I'd like to share my ideas on the problem of evil.
Sure, David, please.
Okay.
There are really three separate problems, depending upon who's doing the asking. So in the case of someone who believes in God and is trying to get to heaven, they want to know why God causes so much suffering. And the answer is that it's like a parent who lets their kids go out to play, even though they might be hurt playing. They do that because there's a higher good. So God causes us suffering because there's a higher good. Now, we don't know what that higher good is. But if you believe in God, then there is the higher good. Then the second one is people who use it as an argument against God. That is an argument to refute the argument for God's existence. This doesn't make any sense at all, because evil doesn't have any status in being. But the third possibility is someone who's doesn't believe in life after death, and gives as his reason the fact that God causes so much suffering. So the response to this is that they're 100% right. Usually when people don't believe, they give bad reasons. So if somebody gives a good reason, you should acknowledge it. And not believing in, we believe that God cares about our welfare. The fact that there's so much suffering is a reason to think that he does not care about our welfare.
Well, David, the classic problem of evil is an attempt to reconcile the attributes of God of being all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good with the existence of so much misery, suffering, wars, pestilence, famine. How could a God who is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good allow so much suffering, so much evil to exist in the world?
I already answered that. The answer is that there's some higher good that he's trying to accomplish. We don't know what that higher good is. It's a mystery, but that must be the explanation.
Or the suffering isn't real. The suffering is the dream, and the all good is the reality of you up and above, here's beyond what
that's
this.
The other thing, that the suffering is the absence of being. It's not being is good.
Or it's conclusive proof that the attributes we attribute to God cannot be correct. He cannot be all good, all knowing, and all powerful, given the amount of suffering, the amount of evil in the world.
That's correct. Since usually non-believers give bad reasons, when they give good reasons, you should acknowledge it.
Or
which are the good reasons, David?
The good reasons. The best reason to justify not believing in life after death is to say that God hasn't given me the gift of faith. That way,
I believe Hume also said, if we draw an inference from the properties of the world to the existence of a creator, that you get the idea that he's pretty powerful, but not all powerful, that he knows a lot, but he doesn't know everything, and that he's he strives for good, but he's very limited in what he can accomplish. And that would be a more realistic extrapolation from features of the world with which we are familiar to the properties of one who might have created it, if one is so disposed.
Yes, I've already acknowledged that that's a reasonable thing to say.
Of Course in Miracles says that the only thing that can be created is love, and that as co-creators with God, we create love, and when we pass on, we see that only the things we've done that are loving have added to the substance of the universe, like light shone, and everything else was just smoke and mirrors and goes away.
So the Beatles got it right. All there is love.
Yeah.
All the meaning of love. Life, and we, you know, the love that we get is equal to the love we give. The love we
there
give
you go.
Is equal to the love we get. You know, and there's a meaning of life right from the Fab Four.
The Fab Three in your book.
Well, actually, it's very interesting, Angel. I think that the Fall was more creative, more diverse, more talented than Paul. It's amazing.
Except as a lyricist. His lyrics sucked. They only went downhill. I don't know.
They're so varied. I mean, I listen to the White Album very often, and it's so many different kinds of music, and there's a fantastic range there, Angel.
Well, that's still with Lennon. Once Fall got on his own, it was all such sophomore, good musician, but sophomoric lyrics.
Well, you're talking about Wings.
Yeah.
Wings.
Yeah, once it came.
Yeah. I don't know if they're so much more sophomoric than the early Beatles, though, you know.
I don't know. I thought they were pretty good.
Love Me Do and all that. I mean, you know, we had a whole string of hits that went right to number one, but they really were bubblegum music. They didn't have a lot of substance.
Yeah, sorry. My brilliant son he's listening. He's handing me cool things, you know.
Oh, I think it's great. David, I want you to have more chances to pursue the issues that you care the most about while we have the chance.
Well, I could give you my understanding of evolutionary biology.
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah.
Human beings, what happened is that human beings observe the fossils of extinct animals, and they asked, where did these fossils come from? And scientists invented the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution is that bacteria evolved into whales in a period of 100 million decades. I'm using decades instead of years because it takes 20 years for a single fertilized human egg to produce all the cells of the human body. So you get a feel for how rapidly evolution is supposed to have taken place. And I'm emphasizing that the theory of evolution is a theory because a lot of people feel very strongly that it's a fact. And one of the most ridiculous things they say is that the word theory has a different meaning in science than it does in everyday life. It has the same meaning.
But well, the word theory has multiple meanings, David.
It's something
theory could be. In the weak sense, a theory is just a rumor, a speculation, a hunch, a guess. In the strong sense, a theory is an empirically testable explanatory hypothesis. And evolution most clearly qualifies as the latter rather than the former.
Of course.
Where I have a chance, if we can go back on the slides, let's see. Let me find what I'm looking for here, if I can tell you.
But you're one of, the theory of evolution is judged to be true by rational people because it's supported by the evidence. Absolutely.
It is?
Oh, sure.
Doesn't that seem like an awfully short period of time to become a whale from a...
Go to 35.
You have the carbon dating.
Can't slide 35.
You have the carbon dating things that supports the time frame.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It happened very rapidly.
What if Earth is the female and ETs are the male and we've been seeded?
Yeah, but, David, there's no good argument against evolution because you have these much more primitive forms of life in far more ancient strata of Earth and so forth. I mean, it has been said, it may have been George Gaylord Simpson, that nothing makes sense in the realm of life absent evolution as a framework.
Well, you learn about evolution by reading biology textbooks and peer-reviewed works and scholarly works.
I don't. I do my own original research on it, which is what I do.
Well, and you keep to the scientific method, so I'm sure what you do is okay.
Well,
in any case, the theory of evolution is judged to be true by rational people because it's supported by the evidence. This gives rise to the question of what caused it. What's the mechanism? And there are three mechanisms. One is natural selection. The other is epigenetics or Lamarckism. And the third is natural genetic engineering, the new one by James Shapiro. But all of these theories together just explain the adaptation of species to the environment. They don't explain common descent. They don't explain how life evolves so rapidly. The only theory which even attempts to do this is the theory of intelligent design. But the trouble with the intelligent design theory is that there's no evidence for it. It's irrational. So what the advocates of intelligent design do is they perpetrate a scam. The scam is to compare intelligent design with natural selection to make intelligent design look better. And a lot of atheists go along with the scam because they don't want to admit that natural selection, intelligent design is a better theory than natural selection.
But it isn't, David. Intelligent design isn't even testable.
In order to
test intelligent design, you'd have to have access to the mind of God to know his intention in creating forms of life on Earth.
You do not have
access to the mind of God. So it's not even a scientific hypothesis.
I have nothing but contempt for advocates of intelligent design. They're irrational. There's no evidence for it.
Wow.
But the important, what happens because of this.
But you're claiming intelligent design is more defensible than evolution.
No. It's a scientific fact that life evolved over a period of 100 billion years. The question is, how did it evolve?
Yes.
And all the mechanisms they have just explain adaptation. None of the mechanisms explain common descent.
That's not correct, David. Do you understand the concept of genetic drift, which is getting a subpopulation of a population in a relatively isolated geographical area where it's responding to different pressures of selection that can yield the emergence of a variant species? Look here on the slide right now. I'm enumerating 8 different causal mechanisms of evolution, 4 of which are productive of genetic variation, to wit, genetic mutation, sexual reproduction, genetic drift, and genetic engineering. The others are mechanisms of selection, natural selection, sexual selection, group selection, and artificial selection. I'm unaware of any phenomenon that cannot be accounted in terms of the evolution of life, that cannot be accounted for by these mechanisms, presuming we also have a theory of the emergence of life from its primordial elements, including the amino acids, under the unusual circumstances that were present with the formation of Earth.
The trouble is, Jim, you can't back up those statements with any quotations from biology textbooks or peer-reviewed journals. I have 6 quotes from biology textbooks and peer-reviewed journals agreeing with me that natural selection just explains adaptation. It explains why giraffes have long necks. It doesn't explain where giraffes come from. You want me to go? Well, I didn't give you the quotes, but I have.
Yeah, but David, I mean, look, I do higher level theoretical work on evolution than those sources you are citing. Hence, they are inferior to the theory that I'm adumbrating in The Evolution of Intelligence and in Render Unto Darwin, the 2 books I published on the subject. I dare say I would invite you to read those and then, you know, quote me instead of the sources where you don't find what you're looking for.
Well, okay. I'm sure that I have a feeling that if I went over your stuff, you never said anything. You never said that natural selection explains the common descent.
Selection alone, David.
I know. This
is so common to try to reduce the theory of evolution and genetic mutation and natural selection when it involves so much more. I've given you 6 additional causal mechanisms that make a difference to evolution specified there. Chance wants to work a word in edgewise. Chance.
Yeah, go Chance.
Oh, I just wanted to comment back on basically, David, if you're going from a religious point of view, and we take a look at the Bible, they basically have on record right there the first case of genetic engineering or a genetic enhancement, the first recorded cloning, basically, I would say. We look right into the Bible because that seems to be the angle you're coming from, where it says that Adam went to sleep and then he took flesh of his flesh, bone of his bone, which until the 60s we would have never known that that was, genome splicing. and this is actually where we have a record of the Elohim, or the gods that the Sumerian tablets and every other religion talk about, came down and seeded man. This is where the missing link comes in, where you've got recorded in the Bible, history and other religions, that it says that he took flesh of his flesh, bone of his bone. So there we have a clone. And then they went, and what does the Bible say? It says right in it that they went forth, God told them to go forth and replenish the earth. Well, what does replenish mean? Refill. If they're the first two people, how do you refill the earth if no one was there? You're refilling. He would have said, go forth and fill the earth, but he didn't. He said, go forth and refill, replenish.
Replenish.
Yeah, because it was already full once before. But it was of those old school men that walk around with dinosaurs, and not the modern man, this new leap that people can't find the link to, because we were seeded by the gods that came down, the Elohim, plural. Just a theory, I would say.
I love it, Chance. I think it's so appropriate that on the 200th, the 200th broadcast of The Real Deal, that you're taking such an active role. I think it's sensational. Angel, you've been doing terrific. David, I'm just very, very pleased to have you here to provoke all this conversation and to present your points of view, which are highly provocative.
One last question for David, and you know what it's going to be, Jim. David, ETs, are they demons? Are they real? Are they many mansions in the house of God? What's the scoop? What do you believe?
I don't believe in ETs. I'm a hardcore scientist. I believe in the scientific method, and I'm against the theory of intelligent design and that whole stuff.
And yet you combine your hardcore scientific approach with belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and Redeemer of mankind.
But not aliens.
I think there's two disagreements between us, Jim. The first is that I consider an historical fact that Jesus saved mankind for meaning.
And wow.
The other disagreement is that all the mechanisms you mentioned only explain why giraffes have long necks. Don't explain how giraffes got there.
Are people saying...
They actually do, David, but we'll have to save that for another time. I'm very pleased to give you the opportunity to say a few more words before we have to conclude our conversation, and to recommend your website. I wish you would do that for the benefit of our listeners, our viewers.
Well, the website that's quite a shocker is on the connection between thermodynamics and evolution. A lot of people think that evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, and it's a mistake. It doesn't. It has nothing to do with thermodynamics. Has nothing to do with evolutionary biology. But the American Journal of Physics published a paper explaining that evolution doesn't violate the second law, but they included an absurd calculation using the equation for the second law that makes absolutely no sense at all. It's a completely irrational.
Local increases in complexity are consistent or compatible with global decreases in complexity, which is the reason why the laws of biology do not contradict the laws of physics.
No, that's not why that's incorrect. You're just repeating the same fallacy. The same fallacy.
I hope not, David, but I'm willing to give you the last word. Say your piece.
The way it happened is that I was reviewing Richard Dawkins' book.
Yeah.
And Richard Dawkins was saying that he was quoting the creationist saying that evolution violated the second law, and he said it does not because of the sun. So I thought this was ridiculous. The sun increases disorder. It doesn't increase it. Then I was shocked to find that there was an article written in the American Journal of Physics supporting Dawkins 100%. And the article is just a complete nonsense.
David, where can we go? Where is your website so anyone can pursue this if they like?
The title of that website is pseudoscience123.com.
Pseudoscience123.com.
Yes.
David Romer, I can't thank you enough for being here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the occasion of the 200 broadcast of The Real Deal on Media Broadcasting Center. I've been very pleased to be joined by archivist Angel and by Chance George. And special thanks to David Romer.
Hey,
thank
David.
You all. Thank you all for a wonderful discussion, and to everyone for watching.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.